Welcome to Manager Tools. This week, Culture, Chapter 2, Core Behaviors, Part 1. The questions this cast answers are, what is culture? How can I create the right culture? What behaviors are recommended for a successful culture? We would love to come on site or virtually train your private client group if your team is looking for effective manager content and training. We do an on-site day or some virtual events for you that are inclusive of the one-on-ones, feedback, and delegation content. And we'd be happy to talk to you about training your private client group. If you're interested, you can email us at customerservice@manager-tools.com or on our website at manager-tools/for organizations. We have touched on this recently, and we're excited to continue it because it is something that's very near and dear to our hearts around culture, around behavior in organizations and professional life. And this is chapter 2 on this guidance. Today, we're focused on the fact that culture is behavior and nothing more, and what behaviors help managers create a successful culture. We touch on this, right? Because culture is one of the most talked about topics in management.
Oh, absolutely.
And people are asking us, how do we create a culture? How do we sustain it? What can managers and leaders do to improve culture in their organizations? And a lot of the stuff that's out there is wrong, as usual.
Yeah.
Usually that's where we step into the gap. We love to come around and say, oh, no, that's not how to do it. So also the stuff that's out there that's not helpful is written and then therefore served up to you verbally in language that makes it like difficult to understand.
Yeah.
And use.
Mm-hmm. Not actionable.
Right. It makes culture, a good culture, impossible to obtain in your organization. So we're here to help fix that problem.
Exactly. What to actually do to build a good culture. So our outline for today, first off, we're going to start by discussing the fact that culture is behavior, then going over the five behaviors, followed by behaviors that create effective organizations. So we're going to start with, and Kate mentioned earlier in this cast, that there is a previous cast on this topic. This one is chapter 2 in the set. But what we're going to do is start with a fundamental principle that's missing from all culture guidance we've ever experienced. I mean, again, we're here to fill the gap. That is, culture is nothing more than the sum total of all the behaviors of all of the people in your organization. That is, what the people, what the members of, employees of, people working within your organization, what those people actually do, that's what the culture of your organization is. That is, if your organization says that it cares about employees, but then lays all the employees off via email, okay, well, caring about employees, you might say it, but dude, that ain't your culture, right? Or, I mean, we've heard this one before, organizations say that in terms of their culture, one of the things that they value is timeliness. But then no one holds anyone accountable for showing up to meetings on time. Okay, well, you can say that timeliness is part of your culture, but it's clearly not part of your culture. And it would be easy. It would be easy for an organization or an individual to say, well, we do care about these things, right? We do actually care about employees. We do actually care about timeliness, whatever the item is. But they have to take a tough decision about the future of the company and the company's profitability. That is, you're missing an essential point about your culture. Caring isn't behavior about an employee. And what is a behavior is actually showing that you are the type of individual who engages in activities, layoffs, for example, that are done so in a caring and a kind and a respectful way. Feelings and values are not behavior. What's behavior is the outcome of it, what you actually do.
That's the tricky part about the way most companies express culture when they talk about it, right?
Yeah.
They say, oh, our culture is one of caring. And they can't specify all the behaviors mm-hmm. that they're asking their employees to engage in. So they say caring, and the expectation is that the behaviors people engage in would include the consideration of care, except, again, the layoffs thing being that example of, oh, this doesn't demonstrate care.
Right.
When companies talk about culture, they express it in ideas, feelings, and values, and not in terms of these are the things that we're going to do.
Yeah.
Not lay people off via email.
This is how to display that care.
Right. Ask our peers how they are when we see them in the hallway. And so there's a gap there. And again, this is, it makes sense from an organizational perspective. You can't make a list of all the things that are acceptable and unacceptable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And since we're here, right, we do think the value or principle of caring for others is wonderful, necessary, and not only should it be part of the values of the organization, it should be part of organizational life.
Yeah.
We're not demeaning the idea of care.
We agree with it. We do. We agree with caring about each other.
Hopefully you've been listening long enough to know that we have encouraged you to care for those around you at work. The thing is, though, a culture of caring, right? And assume air quotes around that, y'all, is in virtually all instances simply a value, an organizational value professed, touted as really marketing for hiring in most cases. And what organizations need to do to actually have a culture of caring is then to define a set of behaviors that it expects to see practiced by all its members. And that's tough to do.
Yeah.
It would be a long list. And also, I would suggest that there's, again, that gap between HR, who are maybe involved in writing down the value system, and the people who are asked on a daily basis to behave in those ways. And so, where HR's need for the value system is in hiring and marketing.
Yeah.
The individual contributor and middle manager level is needing the behavioral guidance. And so there's a gap between like who needs it and why we'd create one versus the other.
Yeah.
I can see why it doesn't always get created, I suppose, is what I'm trying.
Well, that's
the
hard defending. Part.
Well, it is. And I'm sitting here defending HR and organizations for not having done this. Which is going to be interesting because we're going to ask y'all to do it here. We're essentially asking, telling y'all that it's part of your responsibilities. So spoiler alert on that topic.
Right. You're exactly right. And look, we talk about results and retention all of the time at Manager Tools. And what that means is as an organization, sharing, having, communicating a value of performance. It's great. We love it. But a performance culture, it's not the culture of the company. If your performance reviews are done sloppily and they're poorly delivered, as they so often are, right. Then it's not really a performance culture. Again, it kind of goes back to the timeliness thing. You can say it's one of your core values. You can say that's your culture. But is it if you don't hold people accountable? And you do it poorly. And for performance reviews, even when performance reviews are an organizational behavior, they're not effective performance communications.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, waiting once a year to have performance communications with the people within your organization is far too rare to be helpful at all. And we all know this, right? It feels like punishment because you've waited a year to say it. Performance happens every day. Performance just doesn't happen once a year. And a performance culture requires the behavior of regular performance communication in order to maintain it. And then, in our opinion, to say that you've got one. What's more, if managers don't give regular performance communication, regular feedback, while their company says it has a performance culture, the managers directs, they're not living in a performance culture. They're not.
Yeah, that's not the water you're swimming in.
No.
Even if somebody says,
yeah,
hey, this water is blue. It's like, it's green.
Okay. Yeah. From your angle, maybe.
We don't want to overwhelm you with a bunch of negative examples. And we supply these to you because we do believe that it especially highlights the behavior is culture point that we're trying to make. It's unfortunate that we're making it with negative examples. And again, if you say you're timely, but then everyone's late to meetings, you actually have a late culture, not a timely culture. Mm-hmm. If there's a birthday party each month for people with birthdays that month, you have a celebration of birthdays culture. If deadlines get missed and there's not feedback, you have a missed deadline culture.
Yeah.
And maybe projects get delivered, but they're rarely on time or on budget or within scope, then you have a poor project delivery culture.
Exactly. And as manager tools managers, it's our responsibility to, I would say, uphold many of these standards.
We believe that to be true. We believe that the manager tools manager is more invested in creating positive cultures that are reflective of what the organization asks of us. And we can help you do that. Yeah. I think that's accurate. That's how I feel about it.
If you've not yet heard, dear listener, our podcast on Welcome to They, you are enforcer is a heavy-handed word, and I don't mean it to be that way, but you are the enforcer of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
The manager tools manager insists on the behaviors that he or she believes in, and the resultant behaviors, all totaled, are the culture of that manager's part of the organization. And we encourage you to know and believe in and support the values of your organization. My guess is, in part, you chose your organization because of the culture it suggested it had prior to your being hired there. And so it is then on your part as a leader, as a manager, it's unprofessional for you to not uphold the values of your organization. And whether you knew those values or not prior to your arrival here, it is unprofessional to denounce the values of your organization. And as managers, as leaders, we have to do what we can with what we've got. And the way we can do that is at a behavioral level where the results matter anyway.
Yeah. If we consider ourselves guardians of the organization's culture, and we are at the level where it matters, we're at the level of where the rubber meets the road, then, okay, let's think about the fact that it makes sense that we are those guardians, right? Because we can see and hear individual behaviors that make up the culture.
We're there.
Yeah. And we also have purview, and we're probably the right people to do this as well, because I would go another step further and suggest that the manager tools manager is more likely than other managers or more other people genuinely to be aware of behavior.
Yeah.
We talk so much about behavior. We're so deeply immersed into it. There's a little bit of academic creep, I think, a little bit like don't ask the fish about the water as well, in terms of us thinking that others are as cognizant of behaviors as we are. If you're a manager tools manager, I bet you spend more time thinking about behavior than any other manager you know.
I would completely agree with that, even if you're not immersed in it the same way you and I are, Kate.
Mm-hmm.
Because you possess the knowledge that behaviors are where it matters, and that's what causes you to focus more on behaviors. You're absolutely right.
Right. So you're in a very sweet spot, listeners, to influence that culture through behavior. And if you think about it, right, the organization's leaders, the C-suite, the upper levels, really can only proclaim, pronounce, educate, tout, and they can hopefully set an example. The key is managers are the ones who make culture happen by communicating about effective versus ineffective behaviors.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. That is our role. You may have heard that what was released recently was the Effective Manager Book, second edition. It's available now, and it's got all of the value of the first edition, plus how to make it work with remote and virtual teams. You can purchase it on Amazon, or if you'd like a signed copy, visit our website, manager-tools.com, to get your copy today. Now let's actually dig into the five behaviors. And folks, most professionals have a mistaken view of behaviors. They think behaviors are only interpersonal in nature. And it's not that they aren't that. I mean, interpersonal behaviors make up a big part of the totality of all of our behaviors. But our interpersonal behaviors are not the only behaviors we engage in. Moreover, they're not the only behaviors within the purview of the manager to ensure are discussed, are talked about. There are also work product behaviors specific to the workplace that matter as well as the behaviors an individual is engaging in outwardly, facial expression, body language, things like that.
Mm-hmm. We've only ever really done this once in detail in our commented on podcast, Aggregated Behaviors and Performance. So for the purposes of the culture discussion, we're going to go over an in-depth definition of behaviors. And as we do, think about which behaviors you want to define the culture of your team. We suspect more will come from the workplace behaviors. Yeah. And that's fine.
But they're all included.
Right. And if earlier when I said, oh, you're probably more immersed in behaviors than the other managers you know, and you thought to yourself, what? Hey, here we are. We're going to help you get really immersed. It's going to be fun. Starting with the words you say, right? That's the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. There's a difference, audible and measurable, between an individual who asks, can I place that order? And one who says, I hope you'll consider placing an order. Now, both mean well. I mean, I'd go so far as to say, in some cases, some people don't even notice the difference when they hear those two sentences. And we would definitely, surely the people that say those two things, in one case ask and in one case state, surely the people would say themselves that they meant well, but meaning well and saying those two things will likely get you a different result in the long run.
And to your point about, like, does the person hearing it hear them very differently? I think it's almost harder on the end of the person who's actually talking. The difference when you think about those two sentences of you saying them, I don't even know if people hear themselves say them very differently.
It feels like the same thing to me.
Yeah. And the point here, y'all, is that the words you choose to say out loud to others are a choice, and different words produce different results. Your choice of words makes a difference in business results. Furthermore, certain words are known to produce distinctly better results in certain situations. The words you say matter.
Absolutely. So, example, suppose you're a production floor worker and just had the machine shut down. And while diagnosing it, this production floor worker saw a completely stripped part that would require new ordering. What if, in response to your inquiry to this floor worker, this person said, I'm working on it?
Well, okay, I could hear that, but would you want that, or would you rather them say, I'm working on it and I think I have a stripped widget, which means downtime?
Right. And folks, both of those statements are true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on it and I think I have a stripped widget, which means downtime. They're both true, but the words are different. Which words would you prefer?
Second one seems better to me.
That's exactly it.
Okay. Another example, maybe a lighter note. The love of your life says in passing, waiting in line at a theater concession stand, I'd kind of like to marry you. Do you want popcorn?
Yeah. You heard it. You heard it here. We would guess that you'd prefer them to use different words in this marital request. We would guess those wouldn't be the ideal words if you were receiving this question that individual used. And what's more, you'd argue that there are much more effective words and they would matter to you much more than you, or maybe the sayer, the person telling you or asking you, realizes.
Yeah, maybe I just really love popcorn. I don't. It's just an example. So we also have heard about William F. Buckley that it was said that people lost arguments to him, said that they only lost arguments because he is articulate, whereas they just can't quite give voice to their razor-like thoughts. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, you can't think what you cannot say.
Yeah.
The words you say matter. That's the first one, words you say.
Yes. Yes. And the next one is how you actually say those words, the tone, the demeanor, the speed, the inflection. And the way you say things immensely changes whether or not you intend it to be the case. Immensely, enormously changes the way your words are heard by the recipient.
Right, the meaning.
Mm-hmm. Our friend Michael Swenson, you may have heard of him before if you've been a longtime listener. And if you're listening, hi, Michael. Michael Swenson uses the string of words, "I didn't say you had an attitude problem," to illustrate this point. So if you say, "I didn't say you have an attitude problem," it's clear to the listener, well, I might not have said it, but someone surely did. Or if you say, "I didn't say you have an attitude problem," then, okay, well, it's pretty clear that even though the words weren't said, that's definitely what I thought, or at least was kind of hinting at it. Then there's also the, "I didn't say you had an attitude problem." Okay, well, now, surely the problem's not the attitude, but it's something else.
You have some kind of problem.
Exactly. Exactly.
If you say, "I know how to solve a problem," and you say it with a quiet, reserved tone that is inferred as lacking in confidence, then I might choose to give the job to somebody whose words are delivered quickly, briefly, with like more forcefulness behind them, right? Something like, "I know how to solve the problem," versus, "I can solve that problem."
Exactly.
The words you say, and then how you say them, speed, tone, inflection, volume. So that's two. And number three.
Facial expressions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Such a good time. Usually smiling when you agree to do something extra for a customer is perceived by customers as more professional than maybe furrowing your brow and not smiling at all.
Mm-hmm. Imagine you're the customer in this situation.
Yeah. And you might say, "Oh, I mean nothing by that." And I would suggest a lot of people aren't paying a lot of attention to their facial expression.
I would agree. This is my thinking face.
Oh, yeah.
This is my thinking face.
Y'all can't see us. If you've ever seen us in person, you are probably aware of the fact that both Sarah and I have what I would describe as a suspicious listening face.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Our standard listening faces are very furrowed brow, like face tilted back, perhaps not necessarily indicative of our...
Yeah, our internal state.
Right, or our willingness to take on new
ideas.
Exactly. So there's that. And so again, if you're thinking to yourself, "Gosh, I don't really think about my face when I say things to people." Okay, cool. We're helping you. And you should know, you should think about your face.
Yeah, think about your face.
Because
pay attention to your face more.
Think about your face. Communication is what the listener does. And you're still responsible for your face.
Yeah.
And the communication of your face. So bear in mind your face. There's a statistic about this, right? That 7% of meaning is determined based on words. 38% is based on the tonal difference, which is the second behavioral part. And then 55% is nonverbal cues, which is this facial expression topic. And the next one, which is body language.
Yeah.
You got to pay attention to your face.
And I mean, we're preaching to the choir here. The high C's.
Maybe.
That is the folks that are listening to this right now that are both reserved and task focused. You know this one. When you hear an idea that someone else is excited about and you choose not to smile, even though that person's excited, what you're doing is allowing the inference that you're not excited about their idea. You've heard this one before. This is so exciting. Yeah. Why aren't you excited? Come on. Why aren't you excited? Why aren't you more excited? Because people have, they have the ability to see your face.
While seeing, with their eyes?
While seeing clearly that you don't look to them to be excited. Therefore, draw the conclusion you are not excited. And we can totally understand that that is a natural reaction to an idea for some people. Again, Kate and I.
Especially you've just heard an idea.
Exactly. But if you've only just heard it and that individual sharing something they feel is exciting, right? They're thrilled about and it's their idea and they've shared it with you and they want to see your reaction and they see you as not smiling upon hearing their great idea, they think to themselves that you've disregarded their hard work.
And yeah.
Right or wrong, that's the conclusion that they draw.
It seems valid. It's fair, right?
Again,
and then they probably don't think that—
Communication's what the listener does.
And you shouldn't then think of yourself as a person who's good at building relationships if you're not willing to consider the impact of your facial expression and their perception of it.
Mm-hmm. On your relationships.
Yeah, and on them thinking, oh, this person doesn't like my ideas because you have this face, suspicious face.
Suspicious face. Exactly. Exactly. All right, so that's three. We've got the words you say, how you say them, facial expression, now body language. So crossing an individual's arms or crossing your arms isn't always just a response to the temperature in the room, right? Looking down when being asked a direct question isn't perceived the same way as a response with eye contact is perceived. Drumming your fingers on a conference room table may mean nothing at all, but it would be a fair inference to take away from one who has their arms crossed, one who's looking down and maybe is drumming their arms on the table, that that individual is bored or impatient or disinterested or all of the above.
Yeah, that's reasonable. And okay, suppose a direct ask about their status on the project says, pretty good, while smiling and nodding and looking right in your eyes. But a different direct says, pretty good, after pausing, looking down, and then not looking in your eyes, but maybe looking away. Could you honestly say, listeners, that both answers mean the exact same thing to you? Of course not.
Of course not.
They don't.
Mm-mm. Your level of confidence wildly changes based upon those pieces of body language which you're perceiving. You make inferences about whether or not things are truly pretty good.
Yeah. You have all of this information. You have both the words they say and their facial expression and their body language. All this, you have all of this input. And so you take all the input together.
Right.
You're not disregarding some pieces versus others.
Exactly.
That's not fair. So, okay.
Yeah.
This is something we need to know.
We're not trying to disparage one of these directs over the other.
No.
Like, I mean, neither is right, neither is wrong. But there is general agreement about the differences in those two body language approaches to the situation and what they mean in terms of effectiveness toward achieving results. If you want your boss to really believe things are pretty good, it's clear one of these ways of saying it is different than the other.
That's all for this week, folks. Join us again next week for a continuation of this topic. Thank you.